there are those types of attitudes out there about who's deserving of quality. And one of the things I really love about Moody Nolan is how much we adhere to our core values and our responsibility as designers to ensure that we're putting out work that's equitable, that is, you know, caring and about community and fostering that sense of community, and understanding that we have responsibility as a designer to add value, right? And not to go in with this assumption that only certain groups deserve.
Welcome to Tangible Remnants. I'm Nikita Reed, and this is my show where I explore the interconnectedness of architecture, preservation, sustainability, race, and gender. I'm excited that you're here, so let's get into it. Welcome back. This week's episode features a fun conversation with Melvaline McLemore. As you'll hear, we are at similar points in our careers, and I was so excited to be talking with her since she's one of the Black women architects I didn't know well before this episode. We shout out a number of Black women architects and designers that have influenced our careers, as well as talk about her journey into the profession, some of the biases and design challenges that we've seen as Black women in the profession, as well as the frustration we feel when people try to approach Black architects to just serve the role of checking a minority box. Also, during our conversation, I referred to the federal Hub Zone program as HUB, and HUB stands for Historically Underutilized Businesses. And there are certain zones around the country where the certification can apply. So just wanted to clear that up so it'll make more sense once you get to that point in the episode. Melvaline works at a firm called Moody Nolan, which you'll hear about more in her bio in just a second. Be sure to head over to the podcast Instagram page at Tangible Remnants to see images of some of my favorite Moody Nolan projects. You can also check out the show notes for links to some of the various resources we touch on in the episode. All right, well, to give you a little bit more context about who Melvaline is, let's get into her bio. So Melvaline McLemore, AIA, NOMA, Lead AP, is a senior associate, project manager, and Texas studio design leader at Moody Nolan, the country's largest African-American owned and operated architecture firm. She was one of the first 500 licensed Black women architects in the U.S. and is the 16th licensed Black woman architect in the state of Texas. She is a champion for diversity in the profession, including co-founding AIA Houston's Women in Architecture Committee and NOMA National's HBCU Professional Development Program, PDP. Melvaline is the recipient of multiple awards, including both the Texas Society of Architects Claudia Young Architect Award and the AIA Houston's Ben Brewer Young Architect Award. In addition to those two in the state of Texas, she also was recently awarded one of the 2024 Young Architects Awards from AIA National, which is a huge achievement. Her achievements mark a progressive milestone within the architectural community. She was honored by the city of Houston for her historic achievement as the first Black female president of the AIA Houston chapter within the chapter's history. And this prompted the mayor to officially proclaim November 28th, Melvaline McLemore Day, which I think is super cool. Melvaline was so fun to talk to, and I'm super excited to welcome her into the club of fellow AIA National Young Architects winners. So in addition to getting to know Melvaline a little bit more, one of the things I really enjoyed about our conversation is that we were able to reframe some of the conversations that we've had around access to quality design and various conversations of who's considered worthy of having quality design. This is another fun one. So without further ado, please enjoy this conversation between me and Melvaline McLemore. I'm very excited that we connected because I didn't know that you existed. And I feel like we are very kindred spirits and very much at similar points in our career journey. So I would love to learn more about what got you into the profession.
Oh, that is one of those unusual stories. I actually got into the profession accidentally. It's not one of those I wanted to be an architect since I was two kind of things, which is one of those ones I heard all throughout school. So I was definitely an outlier in that sense. I really truly got into architecture accidentally by just checking the wrong box on the Texas Common application. I don't know what other states have a similar application process, but I chose to fill out the Texas Common application because it was my way of mass applying to a bunch of schools without paying the application fees. And I could not afford to pay all those different fees. So I took that approach, and looking back, and I've really been trying to figure out like what went wrong when I filled this thing out. But I know there was a category called interest, and I remember seeing architecture on there. So the best I can come up with is I checked architecture as something I was interested in, not to declare a major. But to my surprise, I got a bunch of letters back that said, congratulations, you've been accepted to the College of Architecture. And I was 18 and I said, all right, I guess you'll give this a shot. And if you don't like it, you could always try something else. So that's how I first got introduced to architecture. Prior to architecture, I was in engineering. I was that kid who loved everything about school, every subject, math, science, English. I obviously love math and science because I really was moving toward the engineering deal. But I also loved art, and I was in orchestra, and I had like,
love it.
I'm a middle child, so everything school was my thing of how I stood out. And I really, really just loved learning. So I guess I was pretty open to what I would discover in the College of Architecture. And I didn't really know what to expect other than when I got all those letters back, I was kind of trying to choose which one to go to. And I narrowed it down to three schools based on my friends having selected their school. And I ultimately chose the University of Houston. And at the time, University of Houston was described as the most diverse school in the country. And that was a big deal for me, because I had been the Black girl in my class for most of my school years. So when I saw that, I was like, okay, this is going to be a great new experience. And we had freshman orientation. We had a couple hundred students in this large atrium. I remember looking around and being like, oh, wow, there's like less than 10 Black people in this entire room. And it was shocking to me because I was like, I felt bamboozled. I was like, oh, they said this is the most diverse school in the country. And it didn't look that way at all. But in retrospect, it looked a lot more like the profession than I had known at the time. It was just really shocking for me that I had read something and I saw something else and it just didn't align. So,
gotcha.
Yeah, that was how I got into architecture.
That's awesome. And I'm curious on those stats. Was it like racially diverse or like most diverse?
That I can't tell you other than I think racially diverse, at least the brochure that I received was racially diverse.
Got you.
Okay. So maybe they were, you know, being a little tricky there. But I think their diversity in whether it was racial, gender, or anything else, you know, I connected my own dots and invented what I thought it was based on some graphic brochure they put together. But they could have meant campus-wide.
That's fair.
And
that's fair.
In architecture, we kind of, you know, we know what the reality of this industry is now, but then I just had no idea of what I was getting myself into. And I had a real interest of seeing more people who look like me. So that was a first little disappointment of like, oh no, this isn't what I thought it was. Right.
I know exactly what you mean. I had a similar experience at UVA thinking it was going to be more. And then like, oh, no? Okay, well.
Yep.
All right.
Yep.
And so then I know that you are super involved in the Texas AIA and various other organizations. I'm super curious how volunteering has kind of shaped how you're seeing architects having impact in the world.
Oh, well, that has been, volunteerism has been a huge part of my career. I'm currently the president of AIA Houston, the first Black woman to lead this chapter, and we're one of the largest in the country.
Wow.
So that's a big thing.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah, didn't quite plan for that, but I have what there's one of my mentors, Connie Revere, she introduced me to a term called helium hand, which is like your hand just floats up whenever there's a volunteer opportunity and you can't resist saying no. So I'm like, sometimes I should be pulling it back down. But
so wait, what was it called? I missed it. You said it's a human hand?
Helium hand. Helium hand, like a balloon.
Oh my gosh, yes. Helium hand. Oh, yep. Mm-hmm. I understand
it
that.
It just floats up. You know, in my head, I'm like, someone volunteer. Okay, I'll do it. It's like 2 seconds, but I feel an eternity. No one raised their hand. So I am that person. So I've been volunteering for a really long time. And I got to see the way architects were able to make impact in the world through one of my very early volunteer exercises, which was the Women in Architecture exhibit we did in Houston. And this exhibit was a response to the missing 32% project that came from California. And my first year professor was encouraged by one of my other mentors. She became my mentor later in life, but Donna Kackmar encouraged my first year professor to turn her thesis into an exhibit. And she had to go back to school to get her master's because that became the new requirement for the employees of the university at the time. So she recruited several of us to help her do this thing. And what was supposed to, in my head, a quick little volunteer thing turned into 2 years of research and production. So I would have never imagined I would have been brought into this thing, but it was so rewarding and fulfilling, and that most of us didn't know how few of us there were in the profession in terms of women in leadership and all these different things. So this endeavor turned into an opportunity to expose the underrepresented in terms of gender. While working on this exhibit, this is how I first got introduced to how few of us there were that licensed Black women in architecture. So we were working on this really, we ended up, one of the contributions to the exhibition was this 88 foot long, 4 foot high display. It was a timeline about relevant history of architecture and the contributions different women had made. So we had hundreds of women because these were just 4x4 pixels we had created. And on this entire timeline, there were 3 Black women. And I said, there's no way. There's no way this is true. And I thought, like, we must have made a mistake. There's no way we only have a 3 out of hundreds and hundreds of women. And it was true. The notable impacting Black women in architecture had come up as 3 Black women. And I remember realizing I had never met a Black woman architect in my life. And here I am working on this exhibit about Black women in architecture. So Googling led me to meeting my first Black woman architect, Dina Griffin.
Yay, Dina.
I read about her. I reached out to her and I was like, hi, you don't know me, but I don't know any Black women architects. And I would love to meet you. And she was so gracious. And she said, and I, to this day, don't know, because Dina, she's been wonderful to me over the years. I know she's just being nice or whatever the case is. But she said, if ever you're in Chicago, you should stop by. I'm going to take it the same day. I was in Chicago like the very next weekend and I was like, I need to see you.
That is amazing. You took action immediately. Yes. I love it.
Immediately. I needed to see it because I was in like a kind of a low at that point of my career. I was in my first firm. And at that moment, it was kind of being realized that in not so subtle ways and sometimes subtle ways, it's being emphasized that you're not supposed to be here, very specifically you. And I was like, how do we endure? How do we move forward? And why are there so few of us? So I met Dina. She was fabulous. And I remember asking her, like, how did you persevere? There's only 0.2% of us licensed in this country. And she said something that I share whenever I get an opportunity to do so. She said, my hope is that one day there will be so many of us, the numbers won't matter. And I said, all right, I got to be on the right side of the statistic. And that is what motivated me to get my license. That changed so much for me. And I had been out of school for about 2 years at that point. And from there, I buckled down and got my license because I needed to be on the right side, whether we were 2.2% 0.5%, whatever the number could have been, I needed to be a part of that just to say I did my part. So meeting her and the individual impact she had on me, and that was a byproduct of volunteering, you know, it's just one of those examples. And I will also say many of the women I worked with and, on this effort, we all were motivated to get licensed. And, you know, learning all the stories of these unsung heroes and how a lot of times their male counterparts got credit for work they did.
Right.
It was important for us to get the right credentials so that we could be in front of the, in theory, the work that we were putting out there. And also to know that working on something that seemed really small ended up even having a local impact, high impact, in that we ended up asking all the firms to give us their demographics of women in leadership at their practices locally, the big firms. And at first, they just kind of ignored us when we were earlier in the effort. And then some of them started sending us their data. And right before the exhibit took place, most of them insisted we update the number of women in leadership. And they were like, we just promoted four women. We just did this. Now we have one's a part. And they knew this would have eyes on them. And to this day, these women are practicing partners and, you know, high profile leaders in their firm. And it was a byproduct of us just shining a light on some stats that would have never seen the day of light, because most of us see it with our own eyes if we're working in those places, but we don't know the reality beyond the walls we work within. So that is another way. We weren't architects at the time, but there was a way for us to work together and understand the underrepresentation and how it has like this domino effect. And we were able to impact not only some women who were already practicing, but the people who were behind us. And that was, you know, through volunteering.
Yeah, so, I love that.
Long story, but,
no, but I love that. The gist of it. And it's one of those things where that's part of why when I started this conversation, I was mentioning, like, I didn't know you, because there are so few of us in the country that I feel like I know a good number of the licensed Black women architects, particularly of kind of a certain age. But then I was like, okay, maybe I need to be a little less. I'm very coastal. So like East Coast, West Coast. Yes. I'm like Texas. I need to know more Black women architects in Texas. So I was so excited to meet you. And by the way, have you heard of the Black Women in Architecture Network and the luncheon that happens?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay. So
we do a version of it.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah. Lunch. So shout out to Catherine Williams and the brunch committee.
Yes.
Because she, when I met her, that was one of my introductions into meeting more Black women architects and realizing that in the DC area, there's a higher concentration, but then it's also just, I'm excited that it's spread to so many other cities now because there are more of us. But then it's just being able to highlight it. Cause I think that's the other thing where people don't realize, or like you're saying, this company's wanting to update their stats of women working to promotions and all that good stuff. Once people kind of realize the stats, they're like, oh, well, what can we do to change that? Or how are we being impacted?
Especially when they learn your number.
Exactly.
Right?
Oh my goodness.
Right? That's a big thing. Yes. Like I was 16 in Texas. Can you believe that? Like
16 in Texas?
Number 16 in Texas.
Wow.
Like the state of Texas. Like that's insane to me.
That's fair. And actually, as you're saying that, I don't even know that I know what my number is in Maryland. I know like on the directory list, I think I was somewhere in like the early 300s. But even still, like it still blows my mind that we've sent more people to space than there are licensed Black women architects. I'm like, how are we? I didn't realize we were sending that many people to space in this country. And now with space exploration being what it is, I'm like, okay, well, if they're starting to send like 20 people at a time, come on. We got to get our numbers up.
Dwarfing the numbers.
I know, right? We got to get our numbers up. Oh, goodness.
Slowly but surely.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad to hear how that impact and volunteering really has had many ripple effects, both in your career and then locally in the industry. That's fantastic. And so then it doesn't sound like you're at the first firm you mentioned. So what drew you to Moody Nolan, where you are now?
Okay, so I will preface this with, I kind of feel like at different times in my life, I realized I had different needs professionally, and or that I learned different lessons from each of the different firms I was at. From my first firm, I learned atmosphere mattered. Like that's important to, you know, have a sense of belonging and feel like you're supposed to be in the place you're at. At my second firm, I learned pay matters. Like being the intersectionality of being Black and woman, the reality checks that we face. And I don't want to say that as a universal, but for the most part, I hear more often than not, that's a harsh reality a lot of us face. And at Moody Nolan, I was what drew me to Moody Nolan. I was someone told me about the opportunity at the firm, so I didn't just like go online and apply. They were looking for someone with my credentials and level of experience. So I had never heard of Moody Nolan. I didn't know anything about the firm, and I was blown away when I started Googling the firm and seeing the caliber of work out there, but also seeing the diversity of representation and leadership. And never in my life had I seen the abundance of Black women in leadership than I had seen at Moody Nolan. And it was so impressive and so wonderful because I had been just like growing up in school and the thing that attracted me to University of Houston, the same as far as like the lessons I learned over my career. There was this unspoken kind of choose a crowd thing with Black women in practice, in that I would be one or one of two. Mm-hmm. And the other person wasn't either, they were admin or something else, not quite practicing as an architect or anything like that. Or they were, but there wasn't a goal to be pals or anything. Right. So there was like this kind of, you know, survival thing happening. When I went to Moody Nolan, I was just blown away how many Black women there were. I was seeing people at all levels, and they were kicking butt. And I made a point of like reaching out to them. It was like this weird fangirl thing. And I'd be like, hi, you don't know me. I just started here. Can I just talk to you during lunch? But they were all accessible. They were all like, of course. And I would have lunch with them and it would turn into, let's do this again. And they became my mentors. And it was so wonderful because it wasn't something I had experienced in all my years. And by the time I joined Moody Nolan, I was probably 8 to 10 years in. I can't recall right now while I'm talking to you live. But I have been in this thing for a while, and this was the first time I had seen anything like that. So that was really impressive to me, really powerful to see like the value they added to at a large firm at that. It blew me away.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I remember the first time I learned of Moody Nolan when I was like, wait a minute, what do you mean there is an African-American owned firm that's like past generation, like from father to son? And it was one of those things was like, wait, in Ohio? What are you talking about? So like the reminder that there are minority firms around the country doing amazing things.
And I didn't think we had to look for them, right?
Right, exactly. Exactly. And it's like, oh, all right. And I know they got, because they were AIA Firm of the Year winner a couple years ago. And so I know that made a lot of people be like, oh, wait a minute, here's this minority firm. But I think a lot of people sometimes assume minority firms are, their work isn't as quality, or they're, you know, it's kind of a shell company, or all the other BS things that I know I heard when I was running a small minority practice. But seeing the caliber of work, and understanding the quality and the amount of work and just like the high value that, oh, it's amazing. So shout out to Moody Nolan and Kurt and Jonathan and all the amazing foundational things that you have laid and keep it going. We'll make sure to put links in the show notes in case anyone is unfamiliar with Moody Nolan.
Awesome. Awesome. And it's one of those things that what you touched on a moment ago about that quality, that assumption about quality, that's the same thing I think minorities architects in general face, you know, that even from just general recruitment, there's this whole little, the best and brightest, we only recruit the best, and it's coded and it says something. And that's not something Moody Nolan hasn't faced, but obviously we've overcome because that initial perception or assumption doesn't last once we're giving access to the opportunity to showcase our skills. So.
Exactly. Exactly. The number of firms, owners, or other people that I've talked to in various networking events where it's kind of like asking them about what, you know, how do they hire minority subcontractors or minority firms or MBEs to be on their teams? And sometimes the response is, oh, well, you know, we wanted to put together the best team for the project, almost implying that minority firms would not be a good fit or part of the best team for this. And sometimes I don't even think that the people who are saying this understand or hear what they're saying. And so sometimes I try to flip it on them. It's like, oh, well, that, you know, we would have put some white firms on the team, but we wanted to make sure we had the best team possible. And I'm like, wait, yeah, that's what it sounds like. That's how ridiculous you sound. So it's like sometimes being able to, right? Trying to flip it for people so they can hear it the other way. Mm-hmm. And they can kind of hear how ridiculous and somewhat offensive that is. Because at first they're like, well, I'm not trying to be offensive, but like, okay,
yes,
here we are.
Neither am I. I'm just going to let you hear yourself. Right. No, that's exactly, wonderful. Exactly. That's a great way to deal with that, because I'll tell you one thing. I was surprised because Moody Nolan's a large firm, right?
We're
the largest African-American owned firm, but we're literally a large firm. And we have people who have asked, like, are y'all hub? And that's, you know, they're approaching us for a box checking exercise. And we're like, you have to be more thoughtful about how you partner. And we correct it, but it's just really surprising that even a firm like Moody Nolan has to, you know, address those kind of statements. And I don't mean like it's Moody Nolan, why do they have to? It's just the size, and, you know, that hub exists for a reason, you know?
Right. And for listeners real quick. So hub is one of a federal program to try and get more minority owned businesses into priming contract deals, that sort of thing. But you typically graduate out of hub after you reach a certain size. And it's typically based on revenue. I forget what it is, but I can double check. But Moody Nolan is well past that as a large firm. Like, that's like coming to Beyonce being like, hey, can you do karaoke? Are you available on Friday? No, Beyonce's not coming to your karaoke. Like, not at all.
That's awesome. Well, we appreciate that analogy, for sure. But we'll graciously address it when it comes to us. But it is shocking. It is a shocking
thing, so. I hear that. So then, staying on your current role, what is your current role at Moody Nolan? That you think you're doing something with schools, but remind me of the specifics.
Okay, so currently at Moody Nolan, I am a project manager. I'm a senior associate and project manager. And I was previously leading both K-12 and higher ed, but I have shifted into predominantly leading higher ed pursuits. And I'm also the Texas Studio Design Leader. So a couple of different hats, and I plug myself in different ways, but that's my current role at Moody Nolan.
Okay, so higher ed. So that is, you know, colleges, universities, all of those things. What are some of the, I'm trying to think, how do I want to word this? I guess, what are some of the positive ways, we'll start there, positive ways that you've seen kind of design of some of these schools or institutions impact the communities that they're meant to serve?
Oh, I've seen it in at least the most positive ways I've seen it is it becoming a signifier or a symbol of rejuvenation, particularly when we do work on HBCUs, and people who've attended the school can remember its heyday. And over the years, they kind of haven't seen the school kind of continue to be modernized. And when we are able to plug ourselves in and have community engagement exercises and bring in the community and produce something that ultimately not only benefits that campus, but that surrounding community, it's been tremendous. It's been so rewarding. And I've gotten to see that high impact, high reward outcome on several of the projects I've been involved with at Moody Nolan. So it's been wonderful. It's been very positive.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I've also heard from some of my colleagues who've also been doing some K-12 work, or even just some other work of having to help shift the ideas and mindset and even biases of some clients or decision makers around how things can be designed. So for example, I've heard stories of some architects being told, don't design that school too nice for those kids, with kind of this perception that lower income or kids in underserved neighborhoods would destroy the building, so it shouldn't be designed that nicely. I've also heard stories from other like interior designers where they've had clients tell them not to design like the the lobby areas or public spaces of lower income or affordable housing spaces too nicely because they're assuming that that space would also get destroyed. One of my favorite interior designers, Kia Weatherspoon, has this fantastic retort to whenever someone starts to, you know, whenever someone's biases start to show when it comes to who deserves what type of quality design. She'll often mention or bring up the idea of affluent white people in Vegas. Let me rephrase that. Affluent white drunk people in Vegas and how they tend to destroy things from entitlement, from just being intoxicated because they can. And understanding that typically people in affordable housing or lower income spaces are going to care for the spaces that they have, unlike the way that hotels will design nice spaces for things for affluent drunk white people in Vegas to destroy. So it's this kind of idea of kind of breaking down the barrier of assuming that people of a certain class will destroy things and realizing that it can happen across the board. So I'm curious, what are some of the design challenges or things that could be reframed that you've seen as you've been working through your career?
Some of those stories you mentioned are things I've heard, and obviously they're as cringy and, you know, like whenever you hear those things, but I think there's kind of a little bit of a disconnect. And, you know, when, first of all, these are the funding is usually in the K-12 world, bond dollars, right? Like some of this work is long overdue. These communities are waiting for, you know, someone to come in and kind of do the right thing. But there are those types of attitudes out there about who's deserving of quality. And one of the things I really love about Moody Nolan is how much we adhere to our core values and our responsibility as designers to ensure that we're putting out work that's equitable, that is, you know, caring and about community and fostering that sense of community, and understanding that we have responsibility as a designer to add value, right? And not to go in with this assumption that only certain groups deserve. And I don't want to imply that all architects have that same lens. Like I said, I've been really impressed that that's something that is true to Moody Nolan's core values. But it is a challenge out there because not everybody's Moody Nolan. Not everybody goes out there and says, I'm going to see the humanity in this community. I'm going to see the humanity in these students and understand that what we create has a direct impact on how they perform. How what we create has a direct impact on their ability to thrive and, you know, like have healthy lives. So unfortunately, it's not a universal approach to understanding our responsibilities as designers, but that is very much a part of that HSW, you know, and
healthy welfare. We got to get those CEUs.
Like we and the quality of space, quality of an environment, that wellness in general is really important. So I think that it's unfortunate that that isn't isolated and it is a reality, but just as you reference your friend's response, it is our responsibility to counter those kind of attitudes. And it can be hard, you know. Sometimes that's coming from the client. Sometimes it's coming from the contractor you have to work with. Right. But it's about being able to argue and say, you know what, if we do this the right way, everybody wins. There's a mutual benefit to us approaching it in a thoughtful manner. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, time has flown by. And so I am super grateful to the work that you're doing at Moody Nolan and to also the core values that Moody Nolan is sharing with the design community. I know at Quinn Evans, we also have similar values where we're making sure that we are adding equity, sustainability, all of the things into the work. Even if we have to do it a little bit stealth, it's still going to get in there. We are very flattered to be joining the ranks of Moody Nolan as Firm of the Year winners and all of the good things. As we are wrapping up, what work are you currently excited about that you're working on?
Oh, well, thank you for your previous question, because I think it kind of full circles a lot of this. There are actually two projects I'm really excited about. Not excited that their schedules are kind of overlapping at this point due to delays, but I'm really excited about a project I'm doing in San Antonio. It's a K-8 project for the largest African-American community in that neighborhood. Not sure if I can say names or not. I think it's public. So it's the MLK Academy in San Antonio. And this is one of those schools, similar to what we were talking about, that has this story of like this investment in their school being long overdue. And to have Moody Nolan do another MLK project, because that's something we really are proud of, is amazing. And for me to be the PM leading that effort is just an honor. So I've really loved over the past couple of years getting to know this community, getting to work with them and understand not only what the faculty and staff and students want, but also what the parents want. Some of them have memories, very vivid memories of going to that school and saying, nothing has changed since I went there.
Wow.
And seeing, you know, it's truly one of those long overdue changes. So I'm really excited and hopeful that this project gets to continue moving forward and sees that gets to be fully realized. That's one I'm really excited about. And then also my other project is the Texas Southern University Transformation Complex and HBCU here in Houston. My first project I worked on when I joined Moody Nolan was the Texas Southern University Library Learning Center. So I'm really excited to be back on the campus. That project is actually one that I was thinking of earlier, which the community came to us and said, we're so grateful your firm had this project, because like we honored what, you know, that the legacy of that campus and what they remembered about it when it was in its heyday. And they challenged us then to create a beacon, something that symbolized the beacon of hope. And they felt like, you know, mission accomplished when that building kind of came into reality. And now we're back and we're placing three buildings on this campus. I'm really excited to be back there just to continue building the relationship with the university leadership, the students, and also that surrounding community in Third Ward, which is honestly, I didn't mention earlier, where a lot of my volunteerism started. I went out and started volunteering in Third Ward. Yeah. Right out of school, this community that I knew nothing about because I grew up in the suburbs. And then one day I started attending these community engagement meetings where they were talking about the future of the community. And I just never stopped going. So it's one of my longest ways I've plugged in myself for since probably 2008 or so. So it's been a really long time and I'm glad to continue doing work in that community.
Thank you so much for listening. Links to amazing resources can be found in the episode's show notes. Special thanks to Sarah Gilberg for allowing me to use snippets of her song Fireflies from her debut album, Other People's Secrets, which by the way is available wherever music is sold. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to the show. And now that Tangible Remnants is part of the Gable Media Network, you can listen and subscribe to all network partner content at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com. Until next time, remember that historic preservation is a present conversation with our past about our future. We don't inherit the earth from our parents, but we borrow it from our children. So let's make sure we're telling our inclusive history.
I saw the first fireflies of summer, and right then I thought of you. Oh, I could see us catching them and setting them free. Honey, that's what you do. That's what you do to me.